In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. Good evening to all. The topic, as Dariush pointed out, is love and spiritual growth, the essential teachings of Rumi. I had a lecture here, I believe some 3 years ago, and the title was Divine Love. In that lecture, I borrowed ideas from the Islamic and Christian theology to develop the theme of divine love. Tonight's lecture is essentially a follow-up to that previous lecture, except that tonight I will draw primarily on the teachings of Rumi, arguably the most famous Muslim mystics that has ever lived. And the focus of the lecture is going to be on Rumi's conception of love, basically, especially as it relates to spiritual growth. Obviously, we can talk about love in terms of marriage, so on and so forth, but tonight is going to be primarily as it relates to the notion of spiritual growth. I will begin the lecture with a very short biography of Rumi, and then I will discuss the role that love plays in Rumi's worldview and how he basically goes about solving the problem of salvation using the concept of love. And then I will give you an overview of the primary ingredients of mystic love in Rumi's worldview. And then at the end of the lecture, I will talk very briefly, because we're not going to have a whole lot of time, on Rumi's religion of love, what he means by religion of love. So basically, this is going to be the way I'm going to present the materials tonight. Who is Rumi? A short biography of Rumi. His real name is really Jalaluddin Muhammad. He was born in the eastern shores of the Persian Empire some 800 years ago, to be exact, on September 30th, 1207. He was born in the city of Balkh, which is in today's Afghanistan. And back then, Afghanistan was not an independent state. It was part of the larger Persian Empire. When the Mongols invaded Central Asia, Rumi was a child at that time, and his family had to flee because of the incoming Mongol invaders. His family traveled westward, went through a lot of cities, and they ultimately settled down in a city by the name Kuniye, which is in today's Turkey. That's where Rumi spent the rest of his life, and he ultimately died there. In the West, Jalaluddin Muhammad is known as Rumi. Rumi in English means Roman. And because back then, Kuniye, the city that his family finally settled in, was part of the Eastern Roman Empire, Westerners called Jalaluddin Muhammad Rumi for that reason, because he lived in a part of the ancient Eastern Roman Empire. Rumi came from a family of Muslim theologians. His father was a learned theologian. Rumi basically followed suit. He studied theology. Ultimately, he became a very well-known jurist in the area he lived in. He was a theologian and also a preacher. But you know what? Rumi was not a genius at that time. He was not an exceptionally accomplished person at the time. But then suddenly something huge happened to him. A little-known Sufi master by the name Shamsuddin Tabrizi, who used to travel across the Middle East, came to Kuniye and he met Rumi. Rumi and Shams stayed together for about 2 years. They had a lot of meeting, and ultimately, in that 2 year period, they became really good friends. They established very close friendship, and ultimately they became soulmates. That 2 year period left a lasting impression on Rumi and his works. So the Rumi that you know today is the Rumi after he met that Sufi master Shams. You know what the strange thing is? Neither Rumi nor Shams were famous at the time. Something happened when they met. The Shams that we know is really through Rumi. And the Rumi that we know today is a product of his encounter with Shams. That was a monumental meeting that took place between these two not necessarily genius people. But something that came out of that became an exceptional accomplishment for the human race. Shams became a conduit for Rumi's spiritual transformation. After that, Rumi went on a journey, an inward journey to find God. His mystical legacy is preserved in a number of books. Perhaps his masterpiece is called Masnavi, which is an Arabic term. If you translate Masnavi into English, it means couplets. Rumi began working on Masnavi, his greatest literary accomplishment, in his mid-50s. And he continued working on it till his death. Masnavi spans 6 volumes or 6 books, and there are a total of something like 55,000 lines of poetry in that book. As I mentioned, Masnavi is in a poetic format. Rumi articulated his mystical experiences and his ethical and spiritual teachings in poetry in Masnavi. Masnavi is deeply permeated with Quranic references and meanings, to the extent that some scholars call Masnavi the Quran in Persian language. مثنوی معنوی مولوی هست قرآن در زبان پهلوی. In the West, correctly so, Rumi's name is synonymous with love, for a good reason. The most central concept that Rumi uses in Masnavi is actually the concept of love. That's the centerpiece of his thinking. He actually creates a religion out of love. And as I will mention later, he called that the religion of love. A word of caution, though. Rumi's idea of love is not about romantic involvement. I will delve into this issue later on in the lecture. But when he talks about love, his usage of the word love is not in the same context as the word love we use today in our culture. It's not even the sort of love that you find in, for example, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Okay, it's a different appreciation of what love is, even though there are definitely overlaps. Rumi's conception of love is actually a very deep an elegant existentialist philosophy. What I'm going to do for the next 15-20 minutes is the following. I'm going to put together for you a chart or a blueprint for Rumi's conception of love as it relates to solving the problem of salvation. Every single religion out there, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, so on and so forth. The central theme in all of them, ultimately, is the notion of salvation. We all live in a state that is undesirable. And we ultimately want to get from point A, which is undesirable, to point B, which is a desirable state of life. Called point A, unhappiness, point B, the state of happiness, right? When you go from point A to B, in theology, that movement is called salvation. Now you are saved. How does Rumi solve this central core problem of salvation using the concept of love? That's what I'm going to talk about for the next 15-20 minutes. Rumi starts his masterpiece, Masnavi, with the story of a flute or reed. By the way, I would recite these poems first in Farsi, the original language, for those of you who know Farsi, and then I will translate them into English. This is how Rumi starts his famous book, Masnavi. Beshnavi nay chun hikayat mi konad, az judai ha shikayat mi konad. Kaz nayistan ta mara bubride and, در نفیرم مرد و زن نالیدند. هر کسی کو دور ماند از اصل خیش باز جوید روزگار وصل خیش. Listen to the story told by the reed of being separated, saying, since I was cut from the reed bed, I have made this crying sound. Anyone apart from someone he loves understands what I say. Anyone pulled from a source longs to go back. This is really the essential problem that Rumi tries to solve. Anyone cut from his source always longs to go back. In other words, in this short poem, the flute, or the reed, symbolizes the human soul. According to Rumi, there is an inherent sadness in the soul of every single living human being. There is an inherent sadness. The question is, where does this sadness come from? What is the source of it? Well, according to Rumi, this sadness that we all have at some level is caused by separation from our source. Separation from the source that all existence originated from, right? Whenever you are separate from your source, you will definitely feel and experience some sadness. This is the sadness that the flute or the reed is basically bringing out in that poem. In other words, what Rumi is saying is this: our individual lives will remain unfulfilled. We will be deeply unhappy as long as we are separated from our source, as long as we are apart from where we belong. Unless and until we overcome this separation and we unite with our source, we will experience insecurity, unease, and unhappiness. Now, according to Rumi, this life of separation is dominated by two very powerful forces. Now, this part of the lecture should sound very familiar to us who live in the heart of the modern world. According to Rumi, this life of separation from the original source basically is dominated by two very powerful feelings. The first one is the feeling of anxiety. The second one is the feeling of boredom. Let me explain what he means by that. Where does the separation anxiety come from? Well, Rumi asks us to think of ourselves as a drop of water. Right? A drop of water. When that drop of water is away from its source, the ocean, where it originated from, it lives in constant risk of annihilation. That drop of water away from the ocean can easily get wiped out. It can easily get evaporated, right? So that state of being apart from the source is a constant source of unease, basically. And that's where that whole anxiety comes from. Now, we mortals feel this anxiety at different levels every day of our life. In other words, we all at some point in our life realize that our life is extremely fragile. As I mentioned, we experience this unease and fragility at different levels. The sense of insecurity and fragility will persist as long as the separation continues. So that's where this anxiety comes from. How about boredom? Well, the feeling of boredom is also inevitable in a life of separation. Rumi uses the analogy of a princess to explain how boredom comes into existence. Think of a princess who used to live in a palace. When she lived in that palace, she was surrounded by all kinds of gadgets, all kinds of things to play with. She could roam around freely, experience a new thing every single day. Now, I want to underscore new, because when you're free, when you can roam around in an infinite space, you can always find something new. And that experience will keep you going. But then Rumi says, imagine that princess's luck goes south and she is now imprisoned. Once she is imprisoned, her life is basically reduced to the confines of four walls. She can't move around freely. And the thing is, life for her becomes a repetition, a series of routines that she does day in and day out. Well, what happens if you are forced into repeating the same thing day in and day out? Well, ultimately you will be bored. It is the routineness that makes us all bored. Again, we experience this sense of boredom at different levels. Rumi, what he's trying to say this, and this is a more philosophical way of putting it, the root of boredom is the finite. Let me repeat. The root of boredom is the finite. We all experience this boredom in different ways. It may be repetitious in work, in what we consume, in even the friends that we have, right? We all experience boredom at different levels. Let's think of it. Would it be boring if you had to eat potato as your meal every single day? It would be very boring. Now, being stuck in the finite will always lead to boredom. This finite may be having two choices in your consumption, 10 choices, or 1,000. You see, the number is irrelevant as long as it is finite. To give you an example, every one of us probably on our TV set, we have something like 1,000 channels. And we're still bored with 1,000 channels, aren't we? 50 years ago, people had only maybe a couple of channels, and probably they were even happier. So don't think for a second that by increasing the numbers, you can overcome that inherent boredom that you have. The numbers are irrelevant. It is really the sense of the finite that will cause boredom in our lives. I guess Rumi was a bit ahead of his time. Let me ask you this question. What happened if you add the sense of separation or isolation to anxiety and boredom? So you have separation, isolation, anxiety, and boredom. What do we call that in modern psychology? Depression. Isn't that amazing? I mean, this guy was teaching this kind of wisdom 800 years ago, that if you are stuck in the finite and you are separate from your source, that's what's going to happen. You're going to be depressed. You may have a lot of gadgets to play with, A lot of Nintendos at different ages. It doesn't matter. The anxiety and boredom will be with you for the rest of your life. Now the $60 million question is, how do we go back? How do we go back to the ocean? Right? Now we know that we are separate from our source. How do we go back? Well, Rumi says, not too fast. First, we need to identify the barrier that impedes us from rejoining the ocean. We need to identify that barrier and that obstacle. What is that obstacle? Rumi said it is false identity. False identity. As long as we define ourselves in a screwed up way, you can never go back to your source and to your origin. Right? The problem is, in the modern time, you know, we misrepresent who we really are. Let me explain to you what Rumi means by a sense of false identity. So here, Rumi wants to explain how this false identity comes into being. Pay attention to the analogy he's using. Someone came and knocked on the door of a friend. His friend from the other side of the door said, "Who are you?" He said, "Me." The friend said, "Go away. It is not the right time. At such a table as this, there is no place for the raw." What does raw mean here? Somebody who is immature. Remember, the guy knocked on the door and his friend said, "Who is it?" He said, "It is me." He said, "Well, you are still immature. I can't open the door on you." What can cook the raw one except the fire of separation? What can cook the raw one except the fire of separation? What else can free him from hypocrisy? That poor, miserable man left and traveled for a year. He burned from sparks of painful longing in separation from his friend, i.e. the source. That burnt one became cooked, matured, and then returned. He went back to the house of his former companion. He knocked at the door with 100 worries and courtesies in mind, so that no rude words might spring from his lips accidentally. So he was very cautious. He knocked on the door. His friend called out, "Who is that at the door?" He answered, "Oh, you, only you are at the door, oh seizure of hearts." The friend said, "Now, since you are me, oh me, come in, since there is no room for two me's in this house." Said, "The reason I did not open the door on you a year ago, because when I said, 'Who is it?' you said, 'It's me.' In this house, there is not enough room for two me's. Unless and until the two me's can become we, I cannot let you in." See, that is really the key to salvation. Somehow, we have to transform an M into a W. As simple as that. Somehow, me has to turn into we, according to Rumi. See, the trouble is, we mortals, every single one of us, is conditioned to define who we are in contrast to others. Let me repeat one more time. We are conditioned to define who we are in contrast to others. Often, we draw mental lines. We create mental barriers to say, "This is I, this is me, this is mine. That is yours," right? Because we always define who we are in terms of a contrast against others. We are conditioned to do that. It is precisely these boundaries, these artificial boundaries we create, that ultimately will establish isolation and separation. By the way, that's how selfishness comes into being, right? The essence of selfishness is these artificial boundaries that we create to separate me from the rest of the world, or the rest of the creation. As Rumi correctly points out in his Masnavi, the mother of all evils, the root of all evil in the world is selfishness. If we are selfish, we are very capable of committing any evil possible. Okay, now the next question. How can we overcome selfishness? How can we break through these limiting boundaries? Rumi says the one and only cure is love. You see, if you have a selfish person in your family, you can never help him overcome his selfishness by sending him to an ethics class. That's what we do, don't we? When somebody does not follow the moral code, what do? We always attribute that to a problem in his head. He doesn't have enough knowledge. Subconsciously, that's what we all do. We think that there is something wrong with, you know, his knowledge. He doesn't have enough information, that he is lying, that he is a hypocrite. Rumi says no. The problem that underlies hypocrisy and all of that and those evils is selfishness. You cannot cure the selfishness of people by sending those people to an ethics class. The cure is love. Somehow, that person should experience love. That is the cure to selfishness. At its core, love is openness to others. Love is openness to others. It is the ability to go beyond one's limited self and reach out to others. In other words, love is about connection. Love, in all mystic traditions, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about the Hindu tradition, the Islamic, or the Christian tradition. At its core, love is about connection. Rumi calls love the healer. Let me give you a beautiful poem by Rumi on that. هر که را جام ز عشقی چاک شد او ز حرص و جمله عیبی پاک شد شاد باش ای عشق خوش سودای ما ای طبیب جمله علتهای ما ای دوای نخوت و ناموس ما ای تو افلاطون و جالینوس ما. He alone whose garment is rent by a mighty love is purged entirely of covetousness and defect. There is nothing as purifying as love, nothing as perfect a healer of all diseases as the fire of divine love. Blessed are such lovers. Love is the cure for all the chronic diseases of pride and the desire for honor and fame. For them, love is like Galen and Plato. In other words, there is nothing like the fire of love to purify. See, love has this amazing potential to purify people. Love can heal. The question is, healing what? Well, I've already given out the answer. Love heals the most devastating disease that can afflict our character, which is selfishness. All the negative personality traits, such as hypocrisy, lying, trickery, deceit, they all spring out of selfishness, and the cure to that is love. You see, selfishness or the ego doesn't arise in a vacuum. Something precedes selfishness. You know what that is? Anybody. What is the springboard for selfishness? Attachments. Attachments. The springboard for selfishness is attachment. As long as we are attached to things, whatever those things may be, we will be selfish. For me, that attachment may be to my work. For you, the attachment may be to your house. For Joe the plumber, the attachment might be to his pain. For Janet, as in Janet Jackson, the attachment may be to her beautiful nose. You see, it doesn't matter. These are all attachments. And it is precisely these attachments that will ultimately lead to selfishness. Now, love empowers us to let go of our attachments. Love enables us to detach from these illusionary sources of happiness. Rumi keeps repeating that it is just an illusion that your body, your fame, your house, your car, your money can make you happy. Unless you can detach yourself from these illusionary sources of happiness, you cannot be free. And when we let go, when we detach ourselves, it becomes that much easier to connect with others. We can then rejoin the ocean where we all initially came from. For Rumi, the truly fulfilling and authentic life revolves around love. To love and to be loved. That is the recipe for salvation. Salvation from all the evils that we might experience in our lives. That's the key to happiness. So, essentially, this is how Rumi solves the puzzle of salvation using the concept of love. And I apologize if I had to zoom through this thing so fast because, you know, we only have another half an hour, 40 minutes to go. Let me pose this rhetorical question. Does mystical love mean love of God? Does mystical love mean love of God? Yes, but with an explanation. Mystical love doesn't mean that human love, as in a love between a man and a woman, is not real. So, mystical love doesn't mean that human life is unreal. Mystics such as Rumi emphasize that love is divine, with lowercase d. Love is divine regardless of whom it is directed towards. Let me repeat, because it's a very important concept is in Rumi's thinking. Love is divine regardless of who the recipient is and whom we direct the love towards. Here is Rumi in Masnavi talking. عاشقی گر زین سر و گر زان سر است عاقبت ما را بدان شهر رهبر است. Whether love is from this earthly side or from that heavenly side, at the end it guides to the king of love. In other words, what is important is to be in love. What is important is to be a lover. Because being in love will ultimately and eventually guide us to the source of love, which is God. In other words, even when we are dealing with human love, as long as it is authentic, and I will come back to this in a few minutes, as long as it is authentic love, you are really experiencing divine love. In other words, according to Rumi and at least Muslim mystics, human love is a bridge to heavenly love because it prepares our soul to fly higher. It creates an environment within us that is really suitable for connecting with God and to grow spiritually. Love is an abundance of compassion. Love is an abundance of kindness and caring. Love is a capacity that can grow. Remember, we're talking about divine love, right? Love is a capacity that can grow. In other words, love is not static. It is not an either-or situation. There is a lot of gray area in between. It's not black and white. It's a capacity that can grow. Think of love as an onion. Some of you may not like onion, but that's the best I can do in terms of an analogy. Onion has a multi-layered structure. So just think of love as a multi-layered structure. At its very core, the innermost layer resides love of self. Now, this doesn't mean pride, by the way. It means self-respect. If you do not have self-respect, you are incapable of loving others. So all love starts with loving one's self, not as pride, but as self-respect. The second layer around self-love is love of family members. Now, some of us can graduate from the first level of love and we can love other people, and we show that love as love of immediate family members. The third layer is love of neighbors, members of our community, and maybe ultimately people of our own nation. That's another form of love. Now, some people can experience a greater sense of love. They can love all human beings. They become internationalists, right? They love all humanity. But wait, there is yet another layer. There is yet another outer layer, and that's the love of all creatures and love of nature. That's all love. Now take all of these layers, put them all together, that's divine love. That's what divine love is all about. The problem is, most of us get stuck in the second layer, which is the love of our own family members. But that's not the end of it. The capacity to love can grow. All it takes is to overcome these artificial boundaries. And I want to repeat, these are all artificial boundaries that we have. These are all self-made barriers. These are human mental barriers that we erect ourselves. Now, all of these layers put together is divine love with capital D now, right? This is all divine love. That's what God's love towards His creation is. It is basically the kind of love that is undiscriminating. It is readily available to all creation. A person whose heart grows this big and his capacity for love grows to this level will have a divine personality. That person is truly becoming the manifestation of divine love on earth, according to Rumi. So, human love and heavenly love are not contradictory. That's what I'm trying to say. They are not contradictory. Love is love, regardless of whom it is directed towards, as long as some basic characteristics exist. Now, let me turn to the next topic. What are the characteristics of mystical love? As I mentioned, love is love, right? Doesn't matter whom you are directing it towards, as long as it is authentic. The question is, what is authentic love? Well, authentic love, according to Rumi, has a number of characteristics and features. Let me go very quickly over the list of some of the more important ones. By the way, this is not all the characteristics. I'm just going to have enough time to go over maybe four or five of them. By the way, before I get to that, let me make a couple of comments and then I will delve into it. Rumi and other mystics point out that they advocate love and not lust. They advocate love and not lust. Here is Rumi talking in Masnavi. You know what love is? It is all kindness, generosity. This harmony prevails when you confuse lust with love, while the distance between the two is endless. There is an endless space between love and lust. And Rumi is warning us against making this confusion. And I submit to you that this confusion permeates our culture. There is also a tendency in our popular culture to reduce love to romance. Let me repeat. In our popular culture in the West, we tend to reduce love to romance, and again, Rumi is warning against making that reduction. Just look at our movies, our books, and how we portray love. It's always like an ache of separation. And lovers are always in a rush in train stations, like in Dr. Zhivago or, you know, movies like that. I mean, that's our portrayal of what love is, this sense of longing for another person that is short-lived. That's the problem with it. It is short-lived. Now, the mystical conception of love, as I said, has many characteristics. As I go through these characteristics, by the way, maybe it's a good time to pause and determine how many of these characteristics appear in us as people who claim to be full of love, or at least we have love for some other folks. These characteristics put together will create an index. I wish we had something like a love score, the way we have like credit score. It would have been really nice if we had a love score, so then we could determine how much love we have. Hopefully these characteristics will help us at least create a mental index for how much love we have. The first important characteristic of mystical love, according to Rumi, love is about friendship. Love is about friendship. It's a soul connection, not physical attraction. It's soul connection. Let me explain. You see, in our popular culture, and especially I think younger folks in the audience would appreciate what I'm about to say. In our popular culture, we tend to attribute love to appearance. Right? We attribute love to appearance. It is the physique, it is the body that produces love. Those of you who are suspicious, just imagine what we do when we want to attract love to ourselves. What do? We spring out, right? And we spend a lot of money buying expensive clothing, expensive gadgets, expensive cars, assuming that a dazzling appearance would attract love. Am I exaggerating? That's exactly what the popular culture portrays love as. Because we mistakenly attribute love to appearance. Let me get a little bit philosophical for those who are deeper into mysticism. According to Rumi, we tend to associate love with form. We associate love with form. Rumi goes to a great length to show that love does not belong to form, it belongs to formless. Love belongs to the formless, not to the form. Now let me move on. Rumi narrates the story of a prince who went on a hunting trip. Along the way, he saw a beautiful maid and fell for her. He spent a good sum of money to buy that maid to make her go along with him on this trip. After a couple of days into the trip, the maid got sick. The court physicians could not really figure out what the problem was with her. The prince felt like he really loved that maid, so he prayed to God for help. That night, he had a dream. In that dream, he was told that tomorrow a physician will come to you that can cure that maid. The catch is, you have to follow everything that the physician says. The next day, the physician showed up and he determined that the maid's illness was not physiological. She was lovesick. She was in love with a goldsmith who lived in her hometown. So the prince sent for the goldsmith, and when the goldsmith finally showed up, the prince married the two of them, and the newlywed, the maid and the goldsmith, were living really happily for 6 months. Then that heavenly physician showed up again, and he said, "Now we need to secretly poison the husband, the goldsmith." So they poisoned that poor guy. He got sick, and he became very pale and very fragile. In modern language, he lost his sex appeal. Can you guess what happened? The maid, who was lovesick, suddenly started losing interest in her husband and ultimately abandoned him. Now Rumi throws in the punchline. عشقهایی کس پی رنگی بود عشق نبود عاقبت ننگی بود. An affection induced by disingenuous motives is not love. It is a scandalous affair that will end up in disgrace. That's what happens when you put all your affection, you invest it in things that do not endure. That's the source of the problem. In other words, we should not invest our affection in things that do not last, things that are transient and temporary in nature. According to Rumi, everything that belongs to the material realm, everything that belongs to the sensual realm, will not persist, will not endure. It is transient by nature. Let me give you some examples of things that we confuse as lasting, but they are not. Youthfulness. When you are 18, 20, you think that you will be in that state for the rest of your life. Youthfulness is something which will not last. Wealth, fame, physical fitness, none of these things last. Now, here is a sharp contrast between love and romance. Romance is an emotional impulse which is usually created by physical attraction. And since physical attraction does not last very long, romance is always short-lived. By nature, there is no damn thing anybody can do about it. It will always be short-lived. As soon as the object of the original attraction goes away, the affection will also die out and will go away. Let me summarize. Intimacy with other people and with God is more about friendship than romance. So, the very first important ingredient of love is friendship and soul connection. The second important ingredient of love is sacrifice. Love is sacrifice. As Rumi calls it, love is the teacher of sacrifice. Love teaches sacrifice. You see, selfish people cannot sacrifice because they only focus on their own needs. They have utter disregard for the needs of other people. But love teaches that we should focus on the needs of others. And when we do, our selfishness will turn into selflessness. As soon as we start focusing on the needs of other people, our selfishness will turn into selflessness. Notice that I keep repeating the word other, right? Other, because that's the essence of love. To feel a deep sense of connection to outside our self. A deep connection to outside of our limited self. To be cognizant of the whole, experiencing one's self as a drop in the ocean. So, people who are full of love have a great capacity to sacrifice. So if you want to know how much love you have, determine how much you are ready to sacrifice for the person or persons that you think you love. The third important ingredient of love, according to Rumi and the mystic tradition, love is commitment. Love is commitment. Commitment is the ability to remain steadfast in the face of adversity. That's what really commitment is all about. To remain steadfast when the going gets rough. To stay the course despite the challenges and the inevitable ups and downs on our path. You know what that requires to remain steadfast? If you want to do that, you have to have lots of patience and perseverance. People who have this personality trait, in other words, people who are patient, they are the best candidates for love. Rumi's personal experience of love is quite fascinating in that regard. A gentleman outside the hall asked me about Hafez. Hafez is perhaps the most famous Persian poet of all time. He was also a mystic. It is fascinating that the love experience of Hafez is quite different from the love experience of Rumi, and they were both mystics. Let me explain. Remember, we are talking about love as commitment, right? Many of us find love initially as very appealing. When we want to fall in love, we think that love is going to be very promising and very appealing, very easy to do. Listen to what Hafez says. چو عاشق می شدم گفتم که بردم گوهر مقصود ندانستم که این دریا چه موج خونفشان دارد. As I was falling in love, I said to myself, I attained what I had aimed for. So naive I was. I didn't know how bloody stormy the sea of love was. I submit to you, this is the way most of us experience love. Now, married folks in the audience probably would say to Hafez, amen, brother. Right? It's very easy at the beginning. If love is glamorous, we have lots of love initially, and suddenly, as time goes on, our love tank empties out. For a good reason. Because we don't understand love is essentially commitment. Rumi, on the other hand, had the opposite experience when it came to love. He experienced love as having two faces. Love has a scary face and a delightful face. To explain, he narrates a story to show what dual face of love are. He says, there was a young guy who fell in love with a woman. His feelings were so intense that he could not even eat or sleep. So, because he couldn't eat and sleep, he was in a lot of pain. He had a lot of heartache. I guess we can all basically corroborate that kind of feeling, especially when we get into love, the beloved does not respond to our love call, right? When the beloved does not reciprocate, basically. So Rumi asked this question. When you can't eat, you can't sleep, when you have a lot of heartache, a lot of pain, would you call that a happy state? Obviously not. But this is the scary face of love. Then Rumi asked this question. عشق از اول چرا خونی بود؟ Why is love so hostile at the beginning? The answer, تا گریزد آن که بیرونی بود. So the insincere will run away. In other words, love initially shows its tough, grim, and let's say very uneasy face, so that those who are not sincere, would live, and only those who are sincere in heart and intentions will stay put. If you stay put, if you don't get scared away from the initial impact of love, Rumi promises that you will see the delightful face of love afterwards. In other words, if you stay put, if you are committed to your spouse, the more you travel down that path, the more love you will have for each other. The only requirement is to stay put and persevere and, you know, really say yes to all the challenges that eventually will come up. Let me give you also another poem from Rumi, which is very beautiful and shows his concept of what love really is. او به عکس شمع‌های آتشی است می نماید آتش و جمله خوشی است. The candle of love is the opposite of fiery candles, in that it appears as fire, but it is entirely delightful. In other words, yes, love is a candle, but it burns. But don't get scared and run away, because it appears as a fire. Behind that fire, there is nothing but delight, if you can persevere and stay put. So the bottom line is this. Love is about patience, perseverance, a lot of hard work and commitment. The next characteristic of mystical love, according to Rumi. Love, get this, love is courage. Love is courage. This is an interesting one. According to Rumi, what he means by courage is this. Love is a gamble. Love, at its core, it's a gamble. But lovers are willing to take a chance. I'm going to leave it at that, and if you want, I'm going to elaborate in the QA session. Love is courage. Now, what is the love-courage relationship? Rumi says, love does not calculate the cost. Love does not calculate the cost. Remember, we want to establish the relationship between love and courage. Love doesn't calculate. When we calculate, it is typically our reason, right? Our rational faculty is doing the calculation. Here is Rumi in Masnavi. لا ابالی عشق باشد نی خرد عقل آن جوید کزان سودی برد ترکتاز و تنگداز و بی حیا در بلا همچو سنگ زیر آسیا. Love is audacious, not reason. Love is audacious, not reason. Reason only pursues profitable endeavors. Love is fearless, selflessly devoted, in adversity like a millstone. I wish I had time to delve into the real meanings of this poem by Rumi. He is really attributing a lot of characteristics, amazing characteristics, to love here. Rumi is making a contrast between love and reason, which is very prevalent in mystic literature. Do you know what reason means in English and where it comes from? Reason actually comes from the Latin word ratio. Now, if you translate ratio in Latin back to English, it means to calculate. So by design, reason has been instilled in us by God to do the calculation. In other words, to do cost-benefit analysis. When we speak of rational decision-making, again, it means cost-benefit analysis. Reason, by its very structure, always asks this question. What is the tangible benefit? What is the tangible benefit? Said differently and more philosophically probably, by its very nature, reason is very cautious. Reason is risk averse. Love, on the other hand, is a risk taker. It is willing to take a chance without any proof that there will be a tangible benefit at the end. That's the gambling aspect of love that I was referring to before. In other words, you might ask, so is it rational, you know, not to ask what's in it for me? No, actually, it is very irrational not to ask that question. But that's the whole point, though. It's a rational question, not a love question. Because love never asks about the cost. Why? Because love is capable of seeing things that reason cannot comprehend. Love can see things that reason cannot comprehend. That is precisely why philosophers do not like mystics. You see, love never asks what's in it for me. It will never come to love's mind to ask that question, because that's selfishness. That is the ego. Love never asks that question. Love always gives with no expectation of return. Love is ready to lose it all. Guess what? That's what courageous people do. When duty calls, it is the courageous that would never ask the question, so what am I going to get out of it? So that's the love-courage relationship. To summarize, love is courage. People who are timid are not good candidates for love. Since we're running out of time, this is the last characteristic of love that I'm going to talk about. Love is unity and harmony. You see, at its very core, according to Rumi, the primary function of love is to unite, as when the lover and the beloved unite. It is the alchemy of love that can bring the lover and the beloved together. So, the primary function of love is to unite, to rejoin the drop with the ocean it came from. Here is a poem from Rumi. آفرین بر عشق کل اوستاد صد هزاران ذره را داد اتحاد همچو خاک مفترق در ره گذر یک سبوشان کرد دست کوزگر. Praise the king of love that fused millions of particles with the alchemy of love, just as a potter makes a jar out of dispersed clay. And obviously he's talking about the story of creation. There were a zillion particles and forces out there. The way God fused all of those dispersed particles together was with the alchemy of love. In other words, according to Rumi, it wasn't knowledge that created the world. It was love. Creation can only be explained with the love of God and nothing else. That is the mystical angle on the story of creation. It is love that brought about this majestic creation that we live in. What Rumi is saying is this: wherever there is an abundance of love, there is harmony and unity. And where there is no love, there is an immense urge to draw lines, to create artificial boundaries. These artificial boundaries may be based on race, ethnicity, on social class, and yes, on religious denomination. Right? When people fight over theology, there is no love. When people fight over theological correctness, there is no love, even though in that theology love may be celebrated. Because by definition, love unites, love integrates. Love cannot stand separation. Love stands for harmony and unity. What does it mean in practical terms for us, we the mortals? What does it mean that love stands for unity and harmony? Well, in practical terms, it means that people who are full of love always see the best in people. People who are full of love, when they meet others, they see the best in other people. They even do not notice their deficiencies and their defects. That is why they can reach out. They can open a window to reach out and basically touch them and connect with them. Even though those others may not look like them, may not speak that language. Heck, they may not have the same religion or theological beliefs. So when there is love, there is this window to reach out to other people. So, by very nature, lovers are uniters, not dividers. These are the essential ingredients of love. Let me spend a few minutes talking about the religion of love. Let's put all of this together. By all accounts, Rumi was a practicing Muslim. He followed the religion of Islam. However, his angle on religion was different from a lot of ordinary Muslims. And for that matter, his angle on religion was different from the angle that most religious people take. You see, before his spiritual revolution, when he met Shams, before that, he was a man of religion. What does it mean to be a man of religion? Well, a man of religion has a lot of devotion to theological doctrines, has a lot of devotion to rituals, to rules and regulations governing prayers, so on and so forth. That's what a man of religion is all about. A man of religion tends to look down on people who do not view God through the same prism, who do not utter the same words in prayer, even though those very same people are trying to reach God, albeit in a different manner. So, for a man of religion, the particularities of the path is of utmost importance, right? After Rumi met Shams, he became a man of God. Before, he was a man of religion. Then he became a man of God. For a man of God, there is no fundamental difference between this or that religion, as long as it leads to God. As long as it enables the person to reach God and become godly. That is a valid path to God. In other words, a man of God is not obsessed over theological doctrines and theological correctness. Now, Rumi considered himself a follower of religion of love. Let me give you a couple of poems on that from Masnavi. دین من از عشق زنده بودن است زندگی زین جان و تن ننگ من است. My religion is to live through love. Life through this body is my shame. ملت عشق از همه دینها جداست عاشقان را ملت و مذهب خداست. Love's creed is separate from all religions. Love's creed is separate from all religions. The creed and denomination of lovers is God. That's the creed of love. Let me emphasize that religion of love is not a negation of any of the existing world religions. Let me repeat, the religion of love Rumi espousing is not a negation of Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, so on and so forth. Rather, the religion of love is a higher spiritual state that we can reach within any religious tradition. But Rumi, anyhow, embraced this religion of love. It is not a new religion, but it is a different appreciation of what religion, any authentic religion, must promote. I guess we're running out of time, right? Okay, so let me stop right here, and I'm going to make a few concluding remarks to bring everything that I've said for the past hour or so into focus. I'm going to make three or four important conclusions. Number one, what is it that makes us human? What is the distinguishing characteristic of a human being? Is it our ability to walk on our two feet? Is it the ability to think and conceptualize? Is it our ability to use symbolic language? Or is it, according to Marx, the ability to make tools? Would any of these make us human? Not according to Rumi. Rumi says the distinguishing characteristic of humanity is the capacity to love. People who are not capable of love are deficient in their humanity. Second conclusion, love has a number of ingredients and characteristics. Selflessness, perseverance, sacrifice, commitment, courage, generosity, and respect. These are all the characteristics of love. By the way, these are also the personality traits of lovers. If you are unmarried and you are shopping for a spouse, make sure that the candidates that you are dating have these personality traits: selflessness, commitment, courage, generosity, respect, a lot of patience, right? Now, if you are happily married with children, make sure you nurture these personality traits in your children. That's the best investment you can make in your kids. Number three, with these attributes that I just mentioned, love is love, irrespective of whom it is directed towards. As long as these ingredients, these characteristics exist in a relationship, that relationship can be called love. Love is love regardless of whether it is earthly love or heavenly love, because the ultimate source of love is God. That's where all the love in creation originated from. This is the beautiful poem from Rumi. از می عشق ریختی بر دل آدم اندکی از دل او به هر دلی دست به دست می رود. O Lord, you dropped an iota of love in Adam's heart. From his heart to others, thus proceeds eternally. In other words, of this humongous love that God has, he dropped an iota of that in the hearts of Adam and Eve. That iota of love was enough to create all the love bonds that you see across history, space, and time. That iota of love was sufficient to create all the love stories created in human history. The fact that God instilled a drop of love in the hearts of Adam and Eve, it means that every single child who comes to this world is capable of love. Every person born is capable of love. It just needs to be developed. It needs to be harnessed. And that's partly the job of good parenting. You see, the job of good parents is not only to send the kids to the best private schools, the best universities. It is also to nurture love in them.
to awaken the love that exists in every single human being. The capacity to love may be untapped. It may be underutilized. Nonetheless, it is there in every single one of us. It just needs to be awakened. And lastly, love and spirituality are intertwined. Let me repeat. Love and spirituality, as we found out in Rumi's discourse, are intertwined. If you read Masnavi very carefully, you will see that Rumi uses the words God and love interchangeably, because he really experienced God as love. So, if we take this thing seriously, that love and God are one and the same thing, it begs to ask the following question. What does it mean to become godly? What does it mean to realize God in ourselves? What does it mean to get closer to God? It means to increase our capacity to love. The more love we have in us, the closer we are to God. It is very critical that we appreciate the link between love and spirituality. You cannot be spiritual without love. It's impossible. You cannot be spiritual without love. And that's the whole argument to separate religiosity from spirituality. You see, it is possible for somebody to be religious but not spiritual. It is quite possible. We sometimes find people who are very devout in their adherence to certain theological doctrines. They go to mosques or churches a lot. They do a lot of prayers, but we don't see much compassion in their heart and their behavior. These guys may be very religious, but they are not spiritual because they lack love and compassion in their heart and their behavior. I guess I went a little bit over time, and I hope that my lecture was not very boring for you. I appreciate your coming here tonight. God bless all of you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.